Tonight on PBS News Weekend, the ways the executive branch can shape reproductive rights and access to abortion in post-Roe America. Then, as a ceasefire remains elusive, what the Israel-Hamas war is doing to education in Gaza.
No child has been to school in any formal sense since the 7th of October. It's nearly an academic year of schooling that's been lost. It's not good being a child in Gaza at the moment.
And as both a humanitarian crisis and fighting between the army and rebel forces in the Congo get worse, fears of a wider regional conflict. Good evening, I'm John Yang. Across Russia today, TV entertainment shows and commercials were suspended. Cultural events were canceled and flags were lowered to half staff. It's all to mark a national day of mourning for the 137 victims of the concert hall massacre in suburban Moscow. Russian President Vladimir Putin lit candles. A makeshift memorial near the burned out concert hall has become a huge mound of flowers. Some of the 11 detained suspects were taken to the headquarters of Russia's Criminal Investigation Agency for questioning. Several of them have been charged with acts of terrorism. All the while, family and friends are desperate for word about loved ones still missing.
At the hotline, they don't give any information. Even now, I was driving from the hospital, but I couldn't go home. I couldn't be alone anymore. It's very difficult, so I drove to my friends. Now, at least, I'll be with someone.
The Moscow Health Department says it's begun identifying the dead using DNA. They say that process will take at least 2 weeks. And as Putin blames Ukraine for the attack without offering any evidence, a barrage of Russian missiles hit targets in Kyiv and farther west today. It was the third missile attack on Ukraine in the past 4 days. A Russian cruise missile briefly strayed about a mile into Polish airspace, triggering the activation of NATO and Polish F-16 fighter jets. And Nigeria's military says 137 of the nearly 300 school children kidnapped more than 2 weeks ago have been released. Pictures show them looking tired, covered in dust, and still wearing the school uniforms they had on when they were abducted. 2 days ago, 17 children taken from another school were rescued. Recent abductions have been concentrated in northwestern and central Nigeria, carried out by groups seeking ransom money. Since 2014, at least 1,400 Nigerian schoolchildren have been kidnapped. Still to come on PBS News Weekend, the effect the Israel-Hamas war is having on education in Gaza, and fighting between rebels and the Congolese army sparks fears of a regional war.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
Abortion will be back at the Supreme Court on Tuesday when justices hear oral arguments in a case challenging FDA rules that make it easier to get mifepristone. That's the medication that accounts for more than half of all U.S. abortions. It's an election year reminder of the role executive branch agencies can play in the post-Roe world. Just one of the ways the future of reproductive rights could be shaped by who wins the White House this fall. University of California Davis Law Professor Mary Ziegler is an expert on the law, history, and politics of reproductive rights. Mary, you've written recently that this is the most consequential election for reproductive rights in a half century. Why do you say that?
Well, I think before this election, what presidential candidates really meant was an opportunity to put justices on the Supreme Court, and that hasn't changed. What has changed is that now, without Roe v. Wade, a Republican president could do quite a bit to limit access to abortion nationally, including in states that voted to protect abortion rights through ballot initiatives or that put protections for reproductive rights in place through their legislatures. So this is the first opportunity we've really had to see what that could look like if we did have a second Trump presidency. Conversely, I think if you have a Joe Biden presidency, Joe Biden in some ways is a sort of firewall against whatever is going to come out of the U.S. Supreme Court. So if conservatives are able to engineer victories in the Supreme Court in cases like the one that's being argued this week, a lot of enforcement discretion is vested in the executive branch. And so one way or another, there's a lot on the line.
Let's talk about the ways that a president could influence this, the reproductive rights, sort of the administrative role. For instance, let's take mifepristone. They're fighting about FDA rules.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously, if the Supreme Court, for example, was to say that the FDA didn't have the authority to allow telehealth abortions in 2021 or didn't have the authority to lift other restrictions on mifepristone in 2016, the enforcement authority, right, the FDA would be the one to say, if someone was violating the new rules, we're going to impose a civil penalty or we're going to impose a criminal penalty. But the discretion about when to do that or whether to do that at all would depend on who's in the White House, right? Who's in that executive branch agency? And it's reasonable to assume that enforcing mifepristone rules that the Biden administration doesn't agree with wouldn't be a priority for Biden in the same way it might be if Trump is in the White House and someone is in HHS who feels very differently about mifepristone. Potentially even those in FDA itself feel very differently about mifepristone.
The Heritage Foundation actually has a whole project of things they want done if President Trump were to win a second term. And one of them is a law governing the U.S. mails. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this law is called the Comstock Act. It was passed really as kind of an obscenity law in 1873, and it made it a crime to mail a variety of items that its framers believed encouraged people to have illicit sex, including originally items for procuring abortion. Now there's language in the statute that says items designed, intended, or adapted for producing abortion. So conservative groups are arguing that the Comstock Act makes it a crime to mail any abortion-related item. And they argue as a result, number one, that the FDA doesn't have the authority to allow telehealth abortion, but number two, that no one really has the authority to perform a legal abortion because every abortion in the United States takes place using some item in the U.S. mails, whether it's a surgical procedure or a medication procedure. So that question is front and center from Project 2025's mandate for leadership that you mentioned. And the argument is essentially that President Trump in his second term could start enforcing this statute against blue states on day one, against abortion doctors, against drug manufacturers, and potentially down the line, even against patients, because the Comstock Act notably makes it a crime not just to mail items, but to receive items as well.
That law is still on the books. Why is it not being enforced in that way?
Well, for a long time, it really hasn't been meaningfully enforced based on the best evidence we have in cases of abortion or contraception really since the 1930s. It's been enforced in cases involving pornography in the interim years, but not in cases involving abortion and contraception. And it's hard to say exactly why that is. I think in part, we have a lot of federal court precedent saying that it's wrong to enforce the Comstock Act in all cases involving abortion, particularly in cases where a patient's health may be implicated or where a use is lawful. There also, just for many years, was Roe v. Wade, right? So it would arguably probably been unconstitutional to enforce the Comstock Act in those ways. So now we have this kind of zombie law that most Americans don't even know is on the books, that the Supreme Court, in theory, could transform into an abortion ban that Americans would never vote to enact.
Donald Trump has begun talking about a nationwide 15-week ban, a ban after 15 weeks of pregnancy on abortion. Can he do that by himself, or does he need Congress to do that?
He would need Congress to do that. So a lot of the proposals you actually hear President Biden or former President Trump making on the campaign trail are proposals where they would actually need Congress's approval. So in the case of President Biden, you know, codifying Roe v. Wade, in the case of former President Trump, potentially codifying some kind of 15-week restriction on abortion, in either of those cases, you would need Congress, which is why conservative groups are so much more interested in what the executive branch can do on its own.
Well, are there things that an executive or president can do with executive power to either protect abortion rights or expand them?
I think it's a little harder for the Biden administration if there were to be a second Biden administration, because Biden would have his actions challenged in court. Those actions would ultimately land before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court, as we know, is very conservative and has been pretty skeptical of the idea of abortion access in the past.
Mary Ziegler of University of California, Davis, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
The World Health Organization says the future of an entire generation in Gaza is at risk. Children are dying of the effects of malnutrition and disease and from a lack of adequate water and sanitation. And there's another casualty from 5 months of war between Israel and Hamas, Gaza's school system.
My dreams have been voided. My ambition has been broken. My dreams have been lost. They're nothing. Myself, I used to want to do well and get grades and make my family happy and go to university and study and do well. But my ambitions have been voided. Everything has been broken.
By some estimates, at least half of all Gaza structures have been damaged or destroyed, and many of them are schools. William Brangham has more.
The education system in Gaza was facing serious challenges before the war began. But today, more than 800 lower schools and 17 higher education institutions lay in ruins, having been either partially bombed or entirely destroyed. Making matters worse, Gaza's population is disproportionately young and of school age. Around 65% are 24 years old or younger. David Skinner works for Save the Children, where he's the senior education cluster coordinator in the occupied Palestinian territory. He joins us from Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. David Skinner, thank you so much for joining us today. On some level, I think many of our viewers will be surprised to learn that there is any education that is able to go on in Gaza, given the ongoing war there. Can you just tell us a little bit about what kind of instruction and education children can get today?
I don't think people should be thinking that it's a full-scale education. It's very hesitant, it's very trivial. But if you imagine that you're in a shelter in Ramallah, in Gaza, there is a very immediate desire for education to take place. And so what we're seeing in the shelters is organic education activities taking place. So parents are coming together, there are teachers in the shelters, and education is happening. It's not people sitting in rows with a whiteboard in front of them and teachers teaching the times table or the alphabet. It's a place for structure and for some kind of escape, if you like, from the immediacy of the issues in front of you.
I mean, just as you're describing it, I imagine that it, on some level, it does provide some small trace of normalcy of what life used to be like before the bombs started to fall.
Those people who are expert in mental health are telling us educationists that one of the most important things for the mental health of children is to give them a rhythm, is to give them security, is to give them some kind of predictability. And school plays an enormous part in that. And I don't want to exaggerate this, William. I don't want you to feel that there's a sort of a fully fledged or anything like a fully fledged system in Gaza. I think it's more accurate to think of the shoots of education coming up within the shelters as communities are trying to care for their children.
And I know it's got to be difficult to encapsulate the experience of all the children that you might be working with, but yeah. Can you just share some sense of what you are hearing from your colleagues about how those children in shelters are doing?
I have children. I think you've got children, William. Imagine your children in a shelter where you as a parent are concerned, they as a child are concerned that a missile is going to hit the shelter, that they're going to be harmed if they go into the street. They don't have enough food to eat. Many of them are sick as well. There's diarrhea, there's chest infections and so on going on. Many are facing food poverty, and in the north, they're facing malnutrition. And no child has been to school in any formal sense since the 7th of October. That's nearly an academic year of schooling that's been lost. So if you had academic dreams, hopes, aspirations, those have taken a hit. It's not good being a child in Gaza at the moment.
You were talking about the schools, and the Israelis argue that they only target structures where Hamas was operating. Have you or any of your staff seen any evidence that that is the case?
I have not seen evidence that Hamas have been in the schools, but it's not my area of authority. I mean, what I can say is that over 70% of schools have been either destroyed or damaged. So one of the big challenges we're going to be facing after there is a definitive ceasefire is the physical reconstruction of schools. which is going to be expensive, it's going to be difficult. It's going to be more difficult than, say, after an earthquake, because you've got unexploded ordnance scattered through the rubble. But it's comparatively simple, conceptually at least, compared to some of the other issues that we're going to be facing. The biggest issue that children are going to be facing in terms of catching up is their mental health. Frankly, it's going to be really tough to try to support children who've been so much going through that. So you've got a physical, you've got an educational, and you've got a mental health set of issues once there's a definitive ceasefire. I can't think of anything that I've seen, and I've been doing this for 20 years now, where you've seen such a degradation over such a short period of time of an education system.
All right, David Skinner of Save the Children, thank you so much for spending time with us.
That's fine. Thank you.
This past week, the World Health Organization warned that violent conflict in Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo is making the humanitarian crisis there even worse. Fighting has intensified as armed rebels close in on Goma, the provincial capital of one of the DRC's most mineral-rich regions. Hospitals are overwhelmed with casualties, and hundreds of thousands of displaced civilians are crowding camps.
I fled the attacks from Sake while bombs and gunshots were resounding with my six children. Since we arrived here, we haven't received any assistance and we're hungry and do not know what to do.
Now there are fears of a wider regional conflict. Jason Stearns is founder of the Congo Research Group at NYU's Center for International Cooperation and an assistant professor of international studies at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. Jason, who are these rebels? What are their goals or what are their aims? And why are they making this push on Goma now?
So the M23 is one of 100 different armed groups in the Eastern DRC, although probably the most notorious and most important one. They're responsible for around 1.8 million displaced people out of the 7 million total displaced people. There's been various rounds of rebel groups backed by the Rwandan government, often drawing from one ethnic community in the Eastern DRC, that have been launching attacks on the Congolese government going back to 1996. So they have a very long heritage, but this particular round of escalation started in 2021. And the real reason it started was geopolitical conflict between the Rwandan government and other governments in the region, and particularly the Ugandan government. But that played out, as so often happens, on Congolese soil. And so it's really difficult, actually, to talk about the M23 rebellion without talking about the Rwandan government itself. Like other governments in the region, they're trying to protect, get a foothold in the Eastern DRC, protect their interests that include both security interests, but also economic interests in this very mineral-rich area of the continent.
Are there American interests at stake here?
The United States has become increasingly involved in the Congo due to the transition towards green energies. The Congo produces around 70% of cobalt in the world, and that you need that in electric car batteries. It's the largest producer of copper in all of Africa. That's pretty much in any piece of electronics that you have. And it's also a very large producer of a variety of other minerals, tungsten, tin, and gold in particular. But I think it's also important to highlight that the U.S. has an interest here also just because foreigners have always been part of the creation of Congo's troubles. It may be difficult for listeners to find Congo on the map, but any Congolese has a feeling that they are the victims of international interference, and they have reason to do so, I think, in particular because, you know, the Congo's history has been embroiled in international intrigue since its founding in 1885.
You mentioned the role of Rwanda and Uganda. What could be the spark that could expand this into a regional conflict, and what would be the concerns about a regional conflict?
Well, that's a very good question, because increasingly it is a regional conflict. You now have peacekeeping troops, or actually intervention troops from South Africa, from Tanzania and Malawi, fighting pretty much against Rwandan troops in the eastern Congo. You have Burundians, a country just to the south of Rwanda, fighting against probably Rwandan troops in the eastern Congo. And so even though nobody is talking in terms of a regional war, none of these countries is really accusing or saying that they're killing each other in the eastern DRC, that is pretty much what has started happening. So I think the risks are very, very much there. if diplomacy and cooler minds don't prevail.
Is the Congolese military up for this challenge? Are they well-equipped and well-trained enough to fight against these rebels and also who are backed by other governments?
The Congo is deployed as a much larger military budget than ever before. They spend about $1 billion upwards a year on defense now. They've hired a variety of private security contractors, especially from Eastern Europe, to help them both train troops and fight on the front lines. And so the Congolese government has tried to throw the kitchen sink at this problem. I think, unfortunately, they have not fared very well on the battlefield. They've been plagued by corruption, by confused chains of command. And I mentioned before, there's about 100 different armed groups in the Eastern DRC. Well, the one common denominator of all those armed groups is the Congolese state. The Congolese state is either too weak or very often actually in complicity with those armed groups, selling them weapons through corrupt networks. And so it's difficult really to imagine a long-standing solution to this problem without a reform of the Congolese army and really a reform of the Congolese state that almost has a vested interest in continuing the conflict given the corruption involved in the military.
You mentioned peacekeepers from other African countries. The UN pulled out its peacekeepers starting at the beginning of the month. Why are they leaving?
Well, the UN is in a phased withdrawal. They're on their way out. The Congolese government has asked them to leave. I think there's a widespread perception, not just by the Congolese government, but by the Congolese people, that the UN has this vast budget. It's over $1 billion a year. It's larger than the Congolese government's health or education budget. And yet they've been there for 25 years now, and they've not been able to bring an end to the conflict. And so there's a lot of resentment of seeing UN officials getting big salaries, driving around in air-conditioned cars, and not being able to finish off this conflict. Now, in their place, to a certain extent, the Congolese government has invited in these other countries to help them fight against these various insurgencies, but that so far has not yet been very effective.
Jason Stearns of the Congo Research Group at NYU, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And finally tonight, an annual celebrated event took place in Washington this past week, and it didn't have anything to do with politics.
It's known as peak bloom, the day 70% of the blossoms are open on Washington's iconic cherry trees around the tidal basin. This year's was 2 weeks earlier than average after the warmest Washington January on record. Cherry blossom season in the nation's capital draws 1.5 million people from across the country and abroad. Lorna Phillip and her sister came from Trinidad and Tobago.
One of our main reasons for coming, she wanted to see the cherry blossoms in bloom. And I mean, just nature at its best.
But for 158 of the trees, this will be their last bloom. The National Park Service is cutting them down later this spring as part of a project to rebuild the tidal basin seawalls, which have sunk over the years in some places as much as 5 feet. As a result, it floods twice a day at high tide, driven by rising waters due to climate change.
It inundates the roots of the cherry trees, resulting in the deaths of many trees, threatens infrastructure like sidewalks. It's even forced us to close the Jefferson Memorial from time to time as the water overflows the walkways leading to the site.
That twice-a-day diet of brackish water has hollowed out the trunk of a beloved tree known as Stumpy. It stubbornly continues to bloom despite being in what botanists call a mortality spiral. It's getting even more attention this year since it's one of those on the chopping block.
Our partners at the National Arboretum will take clippings of Stumpy and create genetic matches, essentially clones, with the same genetic material as that tree, and we'll plant those around the tidal basin when the work is finished.
Well, I'm glad they waited. They're going to wait until after the cherry blossom season. Yeah. So it will be interesting. I will be here every year like I always am.
And as this year's display of beauty fades, a reminder of the cycles of life, both human and botanical.
And that is PBS News Weekend for this Sunday. I'm John Yang. For all of my colleagues, thanks for joining us. Have a good week.